ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. Today you'll get a tour of a very special farm, which is in the business of breeding beneficial insects.
So you are farming millions of these insects?
Billions.
Billions?
Billions, yes, I'd say billions, absolutely. We have to produce them in big numbers. We have a lot of people to service.
And before 1:30 on this Friday lunchtime, let's go to Daly Waters, which is gearing up for a huge weekend of rodeo and camp drafting action. This is all coming up on the Country Hour. Strap in. We're broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC, streaming online, and g'day there if you have downloaded the podcast. The wet season has officially ended. Mustering is ramping up in the top end. And according to the Weather Bureau, one of the most impressive rainfall totals for the 23-24 wet season was at Victoria River Downs Cattle Station, which in the end had 1,359 millimetres between October 1 and the end of April. Now, that's more than double its average, and according to the Bureau, it's a record. A record wet season for Victoria River Downs this year, beating the previous record that was set way, way back in 1904. I called VRD manager Rusty Richter this morning, who says after a slow start to the wet season, it came home strong.
Started in January, really. It was a late start, but yeah, country looks tremendous. You know, it's been a long time. You know, it'll be a good 15 plus years since I've seen it look like this. We've had feed like this before, but just to see springs, creeks, rivers running so clear and the country so wet, water running everywhere, you know.
Because lots of rain doesn't always equal lots of wonderful, nutritious grass, does it?
Not necessarily. Sometimes we have lots of rain and the grass grows really fast, but this year looks pretty good for us. And, you know, obviously we've had the Victoria River and the Wickham River flood out a lot. So last year we had a big flooding in the river, but no rain after it and a lot of silt and that, where this year we've sort of had some follow-up rain on top of it. And, yeah, the country's, all that flood-out country's coming away again, which is excellent.
Right. So going into the dry season, what does your feed base look like?
Oh, look, we've got plenty of feed. Probably not as good as what everyone thinks it looks, because obviously we had massive fires last year, back into last year, across a lot of the VRDs. But that's probably what's kept our nutritional value so high at the moment within the grasses.
Now, have you been able to start mustering, or is it still a bit wet out there?
A few places in the VRDs have sort of kicked off, but yeah, it's definitely put a bit of a delay to us to what we've normally been doing in the last 5 years. But yeah, hopefully this week we kick off and yeah, put a few cows through the yard and get some wieners off.
Getting into it. That's a go. I got told by a young bloke the other day that it's been a big month for motorbikes going down, getting bogged left, right and centre.
Yeah, we've had vehicles bogged. We've had two-wheel motorbikes bogged. That's how wet the country is. We've had to do a lot of our floodgating and fencing through helicopters and just to try and keep ahead of the times, you know.
Yeah. So you're feeling good about 2024?
Yeah. Look, 2024 is looking really good. We just need to keep our market in shape and, yeah, hopefully boats flow for us and, yeah, our market stays strong for us and should be a good year.
I know you're busy, Rusty. Thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Not a problem, Matt. Thank you.
Big thanks to Rusty Richter. He's the general manager of Heytesbury and is the manager there at Victoria River Downs, which, according to the Bureau, has just had its biggest wet season on record, 1,359 millimetres in the gauge, breaking a record that has stood for a long, long time. Our good friend, Sally Cutter at the Weather Bureau. She's been crunching the numbers for us. We'll be speaking to her at 1:05 this afternoon. If you've got a question for Sally, send it through on that text line 0487 99 1057.
G'day, I'm Ben Coates, Katherine, Northern Territory, flat out loading trucks and supplying the rural industry across the north. We keep the ABC on at work all day so that our customers and our staff can keep up with all the news and latest happenings. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Yep, the wet season is over. There's been plenty of rain across northern Australia, but has it resulted in plenty of grass? SIBO Labs is an Australian company that uses satellite data to produce fodder maps, which are free to access, and they're designed to give land managers a better insight into their property's pasture biomass. In other words, how much feed have you got for your livestock? I spoke to SIBO Labs' Alastair Rayner and asked for his summary of the wet season based off his company's feed base monitor.
Yeah, look, it's been an exceptional wet season, and I think we all know that. We've talked about a lot the impact of the cyclones that we've had stretching back really from October through to this point in time has been phenomenal across the whole of the northern region. So when you do look at places like the Southern Gulf in Queensland, across the Barkly, and then up into round into the top end and even across into the Kimberley, we can see the progression of where that rainfall has happened. We've had obviously some huge and damaging flood events, and we know that that's the case. But the resultant impact of that has been to see a really great promotion of feed and growth across, you know, a lot of those pastoral regions and a lot of those areas where people are looking to plan ahead for this coming dry.
So looking at these fodder maps, I guess, who's got the grass? Where has the pasture growth been most noticeable?
I've been watching the Barkly fairly closely, and I think that that's been a really interesting little story in terms of that. And I think reflecting back to the end of the dry season, we had those huge, enormous fires that happened through there and on a phenomenal scale. And that probably made a lot of people very nervous about how this season might have sort of played out, because if the wet hadn't have happened, where would we be in terms of going into a dry season for 2024? And what we've actually seen has been, you know, pretty consistent rainfall. It's pushed down across most of that Barkly region, and you'll see that green progression over the months as we go. So while those fires did do a lot of damage at the time, the imagery suggests that we're getting that growth has returned, and there is, I guess, that comfort that people will be able to manage into this year in probably a better position than we thought we might have been in October when it was all happening around us. I think the other thing that's really useful to note is as you look at those maps, you'll see where that rainfall and that flow of water has progressed down through those channels and those feeder channels, and you can really see when you, I guess, look further south, you know, you'll see that progression of water going down the channel country. So out of the Gulf, flowing down through Western Queensland and down into South Australia. So there's a lot of feed is really happening across that channel country and in that Western Queensland parts as well. And we're seeing, I guess, people feeling a much more comfort about, you know, it's reinforcing what people are saying when I'm talking to them and when I'm in those areas. You know, they say what a great season it has been, and we're seeing that feed reflecting on that.
And this can be seen in what's called the fractional cover maps. It's just super green in that channel country.
Yeah, it's fantastic. That fractional cover is terrific for two things, because A, it's showing what's actually photosynthesizing, so that level of growth, and obviously as it's bright green, we know that it's actively growing and green. I guess the caution behind that is that not all of what's actually growing and actively growing might actually be useful feed. You know, there's probably species within that are not so useful or are less desirable. And we have to remember that that fractional cover and the imagery we're providing is just showing what's actively photosynthesizing. It's not you know, this is a great pasture, this is where all the buffalo is, this is where the Mitchell is, you still will need to go out and ground truth that. So what we would sort of say to the station managers and to the pastoral people who are looking at the maps is, okay, you're going to have a lot of feed there, but it's up to you to now go out and determine how useful that feed is and whether it's actually going to be something that's going to die off pretty quickly when it gets hot and blow away or become a bit of a fire risk, or if it's actually those species that you want to have and promote. And they are probably the two really important cautions to have when you look at imagery. It tells you there's feed there, but doesn't tell you how good that feed actually might be.
So, Alistair, heading into May, what do you think the cattle industry should get from these maps in terms of forward planning?
Oh, look, there's a couple of things that I think about a lot, and I think about two things. One is that we're going to have a reasonably good feed base to plan forward. So there's probably a lot of people who can look at that and maybe make some good plans around what first round muster might look like and what we could probably expect in potentially in terms of weights from some of those cattle. Also, I think then is how we might utilise some of that feed better for some of those cows that are in lower body condition to try and give them an opportunity to access maybe better feed if that's possible, build those body conditions up and actually get some good reconceptions. That'll be really important. So there's a couple of ways that you could use that to be strategic about the way that you might manage that first round. And then when second round comes around again, to go back to the maps and look at it and go, okay, well, there has been a decline in probably our better grazing areas, but we've got a group of cows that that could probably, you know, condition score wise we're okay, but these lighter body cows, we're going to allocate them to a different part of the property where the feed is better. So it is a great way to actually sort of plan that forward round before you start to go into the drafting process. So rather than just bringing them in, bring the cows off and then sending them back, that's another option.
SIBO Labs has now got data going back 8 years. So do you have a sense on how May 2024 is looking compared to those other years?
It's outstanding. It's sitting consistently above the average of those 8 years. So, and I think most people would probably tell you that when you're out talking to people, they will say straight up, it's one of the best years we can remember. So when you see the maps and you can look at that, again, we can provide that freely to anyone off the internet to look at their location and see the season and actually go, look, we are sitting better than the average. And that can also help in terms of planning. If we've been sitting better than the average for the last couple of months, then what does that mean in terms of your own individual strategies? And we encourage people to use the free Australian feed-based monitor for their property to set that monthly comparison up and have a look. So a lot of people are using those monthly comparisons on the free tool to actually go, okay, we are sitting, you know, well above our long-term average. Now, we mightn't include more cows in that, but, gee, that might mean that when muster happens, we are going to have enough feed that if we can't get cattle off when we need them to go, or those weaners have to be held for another 4 weeks before we can shift them to the next destination, we're not going to hit a crunch time. So that I guess that degree of planning is going to be very helpful, but also it might mean that, gee, you know, we're going to have a bigger bulk of feed that will die off. So how do we use that dry feed? Do we need to think about some supplement strategies ahead of time so we're not chasing supplements when everyone else is and be, you know, forward planned and actually get it when it's a cheaper option? So, you know, there are tools there now that are incredibly powerful for locations.
That's Alistair Rayner, General Manager of Extension and Operations at SIBO Labs. Those maps are available online and you'll see them on Landline this Sunday.
This week on Landline, from growing citrus to medicinal cannabis.
I really think we do need to see the government get a little bit more behind the Australian industry to help this emerging industry while we are learning.
And going to great lengths in WA Shark Bay to revive an ancient trade.
We're getting trawled behind the boat, pretty much like live bait. We're looking on the seafloor for cucumbers.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
G'day, I'm Jermaine.
G'day, I'm Caleb.
And we're from Territory Bees. We're out here in Darwin's rural area attending to some hives, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
The New South Wales government has lifted all of its restrictions on the movement of bees, which had been in place since 2022 to limit the spread of the pest varroa mite. Beekeepers are also no longer required to report new infestations of varroa, and this comes after authorities gave up on trying to eradicate the pest and moved to a management strategy late last year. So restrictions just falling away there in New South Wales. The Department of Primary Industries' Chris Anderson says this is what beekeepers had been calling for.
So we've listened to those concerns, we've looked at the risk and agreed that we should lift that control order. So the control order is now gone. And what that means is the only restrictions that apply around varroa are the same regulations that were in place before we had varroa, which are your beekeeper registration conditions, your notification requirements for notifying pests and diseases, and your general biosecurity duty.
But why was it felt necessary to keep it up until now?
So it was a strategic reason, which was around managing the potential impact on beekeepers, because when we transitioned to management, there was effectively no supply of varroa control products in the country. And so if we had just essentially allowed varroa to spread without any conditions, it would have created a significant demand for control products that were not available and potentially then impacted production in the bee sector. So we needed to get that market in commercial varroa control products to a point where those control options were readily available, which they are now. And so now is the appropriate time to remove that control order.
So it wasn't really as a reason to sort of stop the spread of varroa outside of New South Wales and more into other states like South Australia, Victoria. That wasn't the rationale.
So part of that, the reason for trying to reduce the demand on control products was to try and facilitate some slowing of the spread within New South Wales, which obviously then affects the other states as well. Now that there are control products available, if people are controlling, that also facilitates slowing the spread.
And how is the spread going? I mean, is it spreading?
Yeah, so we are seeing, we're seeing two things. We're seeing the spread of varroa, so which is, a lot of it is facilitated by people moving beehives, but there's also natural spread, that bees move varroa as they fly between colonies. And then we're also seeing what we have always expected, which is just the sort of natural increase in the levels of varroa in areas where it is. So more and more colonies becoming infected with higher and higher numbers of varroa, and that's starting to be detected by people when they're doing their monitoring.
So the genie's out of the bottle now and it's just manage.
That's right.
Mm. Do we know whether beekeepers are just sort of going up, throwing their hands up and just not doing management, just letting it run rife?
I think the majority of beekeepers are quite concerned about it and are conscious. They're checking, they're looking at when they need to monitor, when they need to treat. And those recommendations around monitoring and treatment thresholds and things, they still stay in place. They're still there. It's just that we're now moving to best management practice rather than having regulations in place that say, if you don't do this, you're going to get stung. Pardon the pun. So it's really about working with the industry to educate them around management and to support them and also to listen to their feedback too around what's working for them and what's not. We need to get rid of regulation in this space to enable innovation and to enable people to work in a way that suits them.
That's Chris Anderson, who is with the New South Wales Department of Primary Industry, speaking to Michael Condon. So with controls lifted in New South Wales and expectations that this pest will continue to spread, Northern Territory melon growers are being advised to speak with their beekeepers and talk about biosecurity. Melon Australia's Joanna Ambry says it's crucial for the melon industry to have healthy bees.
So in order for melons to grow, we need the crop to be pollinated, and European honeybees are our main pollinator. Varroa destructor, it is hosted by European honeybee and causes a general decline and death in hives if it's not managed. It also can be a host of viruses that also impact on European honeybees. once Varroa distractor does come in to the Northern Territory, it will impact both on on their hive health. So beekeepers are going to have to implement management practices such as integrated pest management. It will involve using chemicals such as miticides. Varroa destructor will also impact on the wild honeybee populations. So there's wild European honeybees, which are basically the same as what you'd call feral honeybees, that have established in the native bushland. So once Varroa destructor comes into the territory, within a period of about 3 to 4 years, that will wipe out those wild honeybees. Now, that impacts on pollinated industries because pollinated industries do use those wild honeybees to a certain extent to supplement the managed beehives. So, yeah, unfortunately, Varroa destructor will have quite an impact over time, but, yeah, beekeepers are going to need to really keep up to date with information that's coming from both the New South Wales government and the there's training officers coming into the Northern Territory and what they're calling Varroa development officers. So they'll be working with beekeepers and pollinated industries to make sure they're up to date with information.
What are signs that a hive might have Varroa mite?
Right. So the only signs, really, because the Varroa mite is very small, is beekeepers, what they need to do is surveillance in their hives. So what they're encouraging is every 16 weeks to be doing surveillance in the hives, which includes what they call an alcohol wash, so that they can check whether there are any Varroa mite in the hive.
What can you advise growers, specifically in the NT, to keep their beekeepers safe from the mite?
Okay, so what we're saying to melon growers is to talk to your beekeepers, make sure they are up to date with all the latest information about Varroa destructor. It does impact on other industries that you have in the territory, though. It does impact slightly on the mango industry. Mangoes do use a small amount of European honeybees for pollination. Other vegetable industries, such as pumpkins. Yeah, there are a range of other industries that are impacted by Varroa destructor. I just really would like to encourage both industries that use European honeybees to pollinate their crops and beekeepers to make sure they're up to date with the latest information about what's happening. And they can do that by going on to the Australian Honeybee Industry Council website or contacting us at Melons Australia to get the latest information and to find out how they can access what's available in terms of training and extension information.
That's Joanna Ambry, who is a biosecurity officer for Melons Australia, speaking to Jan Kahoot. Melons Australia hosted a workshop in Katherine this week, and I'm told the attendance was pretty good. The pest hotline in the Northern Territory, if you see anything strange out there in the paddock, is 1-800-084-881. So this is the Exotic Plant Pest and Disease Outbreak hotline for the Northern Territory, 1-800-084-881.
G'day, my name is Heather Smythe. I'm a sensory scientist and flavour specialist, and my job is to make food more delicious. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. The dry season is here. It's May. Can you believe it? How are aquifers looking in Darwin's rural area? You'll find out in a moment. And as promised, before 1:30... you'll get a tour of a very special farm that's in the business of breeding up beneficial bugs.
So you are farming millions of these insects?
Billions.
Billions?
Billions. Yes, I'd say billions, absolutely. We have to produce them in big numbers. We have a lot of people to service.
First up, let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. How are you, Sally? Happy Friday.
Thank you very much. Not too bad.
Now, we started today's Country Hour having a chat to Rusty, who's the manager of Victoria River Downs Cattle Station. It's just wrapped up a big wet season. Tell us about the data from the Bureau, about how significant the wet was for that cattle station.
Okay, the rainfall data we have from Victoria River Downs actually goes back to 1885. So this is long-term data. We end up with 1,359 millimetres for the wet season. The second one was 1,297.3 millimetres, and that was back in the 1903-04 season. So it's not the latest one. It's last century.
Wow. So the wet season just gone for Victoria River Downs cattle station was the biggest since 1904.
Yep.
Wow. 120 years.
Yep. Yeah, and the third one was 1973-74, and that had 1,228.4 millimetres. So there's been some very big wet years out, so as you go back through history. They sort of spread out because the top five is 1924, 1904, 1974, 2011, and 1976.
Wow. And because, as Rusty told us, pretty much all of this rain has come since the start of this year, VRD has already broken the record for its annual rainfall total. Is that right?
Yep. Yes, that's correct. The previous wettest year for the full 12 months was, again, that 1904. So it obviously had a, possibly like this year's, had a really good start to that year and ended up with 1,196.8 millimetres. And we've already had 1,252 millimetres at VRD since the beginning of the year to the end of April.
You've been busy, busy, busy crunching numbers for us, Sally, and I appreciate it. I understand you've been able to work out which spot on the map in the Northern Territory ended up with the most rain in the gauge for the wet season period. What was it?
Lagoon, with 2,058.4 millimetres.
Lagoon Cattle Station?
Lagoon, yep. And Tipperary had 2,016 millimetres. McMillan's Lagoon had 1,996 millimetres.
What did LaBelle Downs get out of interest?
Oh, let me just very quickly do a search because we can see if they... I've got to think of how to spell. They got 1,363 millimetres.
Oh, wow. Because it's normally up there on the podium, LaBelle, but Lejeune way up there on the WA border, topping the scales.
Well, that sort of fits in because there's a band through there, down through VRD and down towards Tennant Creek. That's the first 4 months of the year, so it was above the long term average. So it fits it somewhere down there. Got the record.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. All right then. Thank you for all that work for us, Sally Cutter. Looking ahead to the weekend, what can Territorians expect?
Well, so showers continuing around the far northeast corner, though they're going to get a bit fewer and further between until early next week or early to mid next week. But the weekend's going to be pretty clear. Might be some cloud around. In the southern parts, we're still going to see relatively clear skies and the wind through the Barkly still. So it's probably Barkly windy. The other places not quite so windy. But when you start looking at the temperatures, it's relatively pleasant as well. So Daly Waters with the weekend bash out there, it's 33 degrees today, 33 tomorrow, 32 Sunday, 31 Monday.
What about overnight temps at Daly Waters after, you know, you had a big night at the rodeo and you're getting into your swag? What are the overnight temperatures like for Daly Waters?
Well, 21 tomorrow morning and then 19. So
that's nice.
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good, yeah.
Nice. What about the weekend ahead for fishers? What are coastal waters doing?
Still a little bit windy out there. We do have a coastal wind warning out for the Gove Peninsula coast, and it looks like one's going to be going out again for tomorrow. If you're on the west coast, we're looking for the next couple of days, generally 10 or 15 knots, but could be reaching up 15 to 20 knots in the morning. So just be careful if you are heading out along the north coast. The wind's reaching up to 25 knots offshore in the morning on Saturday, maybe easing slightly on Sunday, but there's still 15 to 20 knots out there, southeasterlies. And around in the Gulf of Carpentaria, we're looking for winds up to 25 knots offshore south of Numbawa during the morning, and Sunday just generally 15 to 25 knots.
Okay. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon, Sally. Really appreciate it.
That's okay.
Sally Cutter at the Weather Bureau. It's 11 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Shout out to everyone at Daly Waters. Big weekend ahead of rodeo, camp drafting, and much, much more. I can see producer Dan just ripping his hair out. He's having trouble getting hold of our rodeo correspondent there at Daly Waters. Should I do a shout out, Dan? We might have a correspondent listening this afternoon who's there at the grounds who can take us there. Our phone number at the Country Hour for those at Daly Waters, 1-300-057-222. The dry season's here. Rodeo action underway in the top end. I love it. We're just having trouble getting hold of our correspondent. So if you're at Daly Waters, we need you. 1-300-057-222 is our phone number.
I'm Jack O'Neill Valentine. I'm ringing at Hakata Station. And I'm originally from Calliope in Queensland. And I listen to the Country Hour.
It's the way to go. It's a Friday lunchtime. The dry season is here. How are those aquifers looking in Darwin's rural area? Once a month, we speak to Adrian Costa, who's the Director of Water Assessment with the NT Government. Adrian, groundwater levels around Darwin, how are things looking?
Yeah, Matt, we saw our peaks in March, and as your listeners would know, across the Darwin area and quite widely across the Northern Territory, we haven't had a lot of rainfall in April. So what that's meant is we're now on the recession curve. So we dropped about a metre and a half in the Howard groundwater system that underlies the Greater Darwin, and around a 2 metre drop or fall in the last month on the Berry Springs system. We're looking about half a metre lower than we were last year. However, our peak, so that peak in mid-March was higher than the last two seasons. So we're looking good, but, you know, the dry could go for another, you know, 6 or 7 months, depending on when that onset comes in. Generally, it comes in late October, early November, but if we have a late one, it could be December like we had last year. And so it could be, you know, as I said, 6 or 7 months of dry.
Berry Springs dropping 2 metres in April. How significant is that?
Look, it's about a half a metre lower than it was last year. That aquifer, you know, when we do our predictive end of dry, which is sort of around the end of November, we think that it probably dips to around, or observations dip to around 20 metres below. So we're currently sitting at about 12 metres below, so we've got about 8 metres of available drawdown, if you like. So, look, it is a bit of a – we're definitely on the recession curve. We're looking a little bit lower than last year. You know, we've got 6 or 7 months of no rain. So, you know, it really depends on when those early rains come in, so or if we do get early rains.
It's all downhill from here.
It is. But the good news is if you look at the Katherine area, and it's the Cambrian limestone aquifer there, which is a little bit different. It's got a lot more storage in it. Had a lot of rain, obviously, in the Katherine and Tennant Creek areas as well. That's looking pretty good. That aquifer is around about a metre above where it was last year. So definitely it's on its recession curve as well, but things are looking quite resilient in that area.
Thanks for your time today.
Not a problem. Good to be with you, Matt.
G'day, I'm Lisa Pepper and I'm in here at Darwin Port, where we're currently in the process of loading a couple of thousand head onto the Greyman Express for live export. And thanks for listening to the Country Hour.
And as we go to air this afternoon, Darwin River Dam is sitting at 97%. Not bad. It is 1:15. Over the last few weeks here on the Country Hour, we've been talking a lot about an exotic pest called papaya mealybug. This pest has been getting stuck into our fringe of penny trees around Darwin. It's been killing pawpaw trees. It's been awful. But one of the weapons being used against this pest is a native ladybird. And it's been doing a great job, these ladybirds. Did you know that there are a couple of locations around Australia that breed up beneficial insects? That's the business. That's the job. Country Hour reporter Jennifer Nichols went to check out one of these bug farms just north of Brisbane.
My name's James Hill. I'm the operations manager at the Donnybrook site for Bugs for Bucks.
Now, we're here at the insectary, and gee, it's grown a lot since I was last here, probably around 2016.
Yeah, that's correct. So we've probably doubled in size since then, and we currently have 30 tunnels, and we're itching to get bigger, I guess.
And I guess it's self-explanatory, Bugs for Bugs. So you're breeding beneficial insects.
Beneficial insects for farmers to use instead of insecticides.
So you are farming millions of these insects.
Billions.
Billions?
Billions. Yes, I'd say billions, absolutely. We have to produce them in big numbers. We have a lot of people to service.
So. Oh, it's mind-blowing. And how far afield do they get sent? And how do you send them and keep them alive?
We send them Australia-wide. We send them with ice, which keeps them nice and cool. And when they're below 9 degrees, they're in hibernation. And when the farmer puts them out into his field, they come out of diapause and go and do their thing in their paddocks.
I have seen drones in the past going out and dropping them.
They do go out and drop them with drones. Depends on the size of the area that the farmer has a problem with. If he would like to do his whole farm, a drone is a good option. But they do sprinkle them out by hand, which can be a little bit time consuming.
How has the acceptance of this industry grown over time?
I'd say it's definitely on the up as newer farmers are coming on board. IPM is taught in ag schools now, so the new farmers coming through are well aware of it.
Integrated pest management
Integrated pest management. Yeah, about 90% of the farmers are using it at the moment, which is exceptional. These were harvested this morning.
James Hill's wife, Deb, is busy in this room where the insects are all packed up.
I think it's sort of cutting edge. It's great that we're trying to cut down on insecticides and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, it's really interesting. It's good. It's good fun. And it's always interesting when, you know, driving around in the car or when people see your shirt and they're like, oh, what's that about? Everyone's really interested in it. So that's good too.
It would put vermiculite into a tube, and then she gets this little machine and it sucks it out of that cup, distributes it into the tube, and they climb up through the vermiculite, and then the farmer spreads it out.
10,000 mites in that packet. Deb, did you count that 10,000 mites?
I did not.
We go by weight.
Okay.
And it'd take me all day.
They have been counted, though.
Oh, wow.
They do get counted to calibrate the machine.
Yep.
Once the machine's calibrated, Deb will calibrate it by weight every day, and we know how much is in that.
Wow.
Counting 10,000 mites is a little bit difficult. Yeah.
And so they go off now in their little express post bags and get sent wherever they need.
Everywhere. Yeah, all over Australia.
That's Deb and James Hill from Bugs for Bugs, which I understand has been getting a lot of calls from the Northern Territory. It is 19 past one, and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Some really, really good news for Australia's wine industry. It's taken about 4 years, but wine is starting to flow back into China. I'll tell you more about it after this song by Cold Chisel.
Once I smoked a Dannemann cigar, I drove a foreign car, oh, baby, that was years ago. But come on.
22 past one, and we are talking wine on a Friday lunchtime. The good news for Australia's wine industry is that the good stuff is starting to flow into China again. So Australian wine is heading to China for the first time in about 4 years after Beijing finally lifted those heavy, heavy tariffs. Mark Hunter is a winemaker in Victoria and says the first few pallets of wine from his family's vineyard have been sent off to distributors ready to go for Chinese consumption.
Really good to know the distributor was so keen to get straight back into it, because obviously for 4 years they've been selling wine from another part of the world, not selling Australian wine. So it was great that they sort of fully hadn't transitioned out of Australian wine and were very keen and, you know, put in a bigger order than they had in previous years when we were open. So they were very keen to get going and thought that there was a really positive market in China for Australian wine. So, it's all looking very optimistic and very good at the moment.
I know that the China market is more for the luxury end of your wines and it's not necessarily the make or break for your business day to day, but did you have a fair bit of wine sitting in the cellar just waiting for China to give you the A-OK?
Not really. It's sort of come out of stock that would otherwise be sold locally. But thankfully, I don't know about other regions of Australia, but we've had probably three or four really decent vintages in a row. So 2020 was a really shocking vintage. But every year since that, we've had above average yields and, you know, really, really great wines. So, but, you know, not having China, we've had to really focus on the local market and selling in the local market. So that's sort of been the focus. And China's sort of the cream on the top, you know, that just helps move a little bit more stock. And we can start planning over the next year or two if we need to bring more in or funnel more towards China away from other areas. So, yeah, it's a nice position to be in.
You mentioned earlier that there was actually a larger order than you were expecting coming from China via your distributors. Did that also reflect an uptick in price?
Yes, so they certainly were buying most of our high-end products with that. And I guess, too, maybe because there is zero stock in China, that's why the amount has grown. But I'm not sure what they're thinking will happen once wine, you know, Australian wine hits the market again. But it seems fairly optimistic, and a large order kind of indicates that they are feeling optimistic about what will happen once it's there.
Considering that there was that hole in the market, do you think that China at all changed their taste for wine, or were they just waiting for us to reopen?
I probably couldn't answer that accurately. I think it's a wait and see issue. I think there's a love of Australian products within China. I think there's that sort of real clean green kind of ideals about Australian products and quality of the product. So I think they're, you know, and maybe they're a bit more fruit forward wine. So, you know, who knows? That's kind of a difficult one to answer. It'll be interesting to to even get back over to China myself and to see what the market's doing, and just to see what this first shipment, where it sells and who it sells to. And so there's a lot of questions, I think, at the moment. So, because it's been quite a few years, I guess they would have had a surplus of Australian wine there for a number of years following the ban of Australian wines. But yes, it's been a few years without it, but maybe not long enough to change anything.
Have you spoken with any other producers, either in your region or more further afield, about the market reopening, or is it pretty tight-lipped at the moment?
I think it's fairly tight-lipped because there was a fair bit of organising to do getting wine over there. All I know is that there's certainly a few of my friends who were very heavily involved in China that they're getting a lot of interest in sort of sending large volumes over. So that's as far as I know. I don't know of anyone else who's got a shipment on a ship yet. So, but I'm sure there's plenty on its way over.
That is Mark Hunter, who is a winemaker in Victoria, speaking to Jane McNaughton. That's big news for that industry. The wine is once again flowing to China. Now, finally today on the Country Hour, let's go to Daly Waters. Big few days ahead of rodeo and camp draft action. We're joined this afternoon by Des Carey, president of the Daly Waters Rodeo Camp Draft Committee. He's right there amongst it. How's it looking, Des?
Yeah, Matt, looking really good. Bit of a bit smaller turnout because of the big wet we've had. Big season. It's only just started to dry out, so a lot of people haven't been able to make it, not still being able to get out of their stations, but still a good turnout.
Beauty. And I can hear the action in the background. What's happening there this afternoon?
We've got the can draft on today, and later on tonight we've got the first night of the rodeo. We've got a rodeo tonight and tomorrow night. We got one of the specialties in the rodeo. We've got an undies race, so that's normally just gets pretty exciting.
Good weather for it. The dry season's here. Good weather, yep.
Beautiful weather at the moment, mate. Really good. Couldn't ask for better.
Can you tell our audience about the prize money? Only that I had someone tap me on the shoulder today and said, holy smoke, look at some of these dollars.
Yeah, so we've got a really big open here. It's three rounds, so you've basically got three. You've got two first rounds, and then you go through to the third round, that's a final, and now first place gets $10,000.
Phew.
Yeah. And then in the encouragement, which is the where you start off from for all the junior ringers and that sort of thing, we've got a brand new saddle that's probably valued at $3,000 or $4,000.
As always with these events, they can't happen without generous donations. Who supplied the cattle this year for Daly Waters?
Yeah, the place that we're on, Kalala, Rallon Australia have supplied all the cattle for the whole weekend. So it's a pretty big effort by all of our team and everyone around us. It's a really big community event and everybody hooks in and helps, which sets precedence for everybody, you know, and gets everybody going.
Yeah. Radio Cam Draft Circuit underway for the year. If anyone's near Daly Waters this weekend, Rodeo Ground's a place to be. I'd imagine the local pub might sell a few tonight.
Yeah, no, I got a few last night, a few fresh ringers going in there, and there's a few sore heads this morning, and no doubt there's going to be a few more of those yet to come.
Des, wishing you and the team all the best for the weekend ahead. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Matt.
That's Des Carey. He's out at Daly Waters this afternoon. Plenty of rodeo and cam draft in action across the weekend. That's it for today's Country Hour. Keep it rural.